DiscerningHearts.com presents Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by Al Cresta, who is a broadcaster, journalist, president and CEO of Ave Maria Communication, and host of the nationally syndicated Catholic talk show, Cresta in the Afternoon. Al is the co-author with Nick Tom of Moments of Grace, Inspiring Stories from Well-Known Catholics, and is the author of Why Do Catholics Genuflect? And Why Are Catholics So Concerned About Sin? With Al Cresta, we go inside the pages of Dangers to the Faith, Recognizing Catholicism's 21st Century Opponents, published by Our Sunday Visitor. Al, thank you so much for joining me.
Chris, it's a pleasure, and I remember the last time we talked on one of my earlier books, and I loved that interview, and I'm looking forward to this one.
It is a joy to bring forth something that so many people have been searching for. Here it is, Dangers to the Faith, Recognizing Catholicism's 21st Century Opponents. This book, Al, it answers that need that so many, particularly in this year of faith, have been searching for, because you unravel so many knots for people as far as their quest to be able to pass on the faith to others. So thank you.
Well, thanks. It sounds as though you've got a good pulse on what I was trying to do. So thank you.
So many of the different areas, the different parts in which you address in the book, they're actually in some ways interwoven, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they are. Yeah, because Catholics have to understand that even though there are many competing philosophies and competing social movements, and we shouldn't forget that there's a fundamental divide, and that divide is between those who believe that life is the product of some kind of creation. In other words, that there is some divinity, some intelligence, something before things were, and that God, that intelligence, that force, whatever you want to call it, ordered existence. And so there is a norm to life. There are commandments we follow. There are values that we're supposed to embrace. In other words, life has a purpose. Life makes sense. And life has an intelligent origin. The world can be divided up between people who believe that and people who believe that life is nothing more than an impersonal accident, something that got thrown up without any prevision of the end that was being achieved, some material force, some energy, and that, in fact, there is no intrinsic morality or intrinsic dignity. So the world either had a personal beginning or an impersonal beginning. It had an intelligent beginning or an irrational beginning. And the world is divided up between those who choose one side or the other. And once we keep that in mind, all the opponents of the Catholic faith can eventually be brought back to that first principle, that ultimately they don't believe that life is originally personal or intelligent or loving. So that's why the chapters are interrelated. They are all part of a spirit, a common spirit of opposition to the Catholic faith. And in fact, in most cases, opposed to a personal God and opposed to the idea that he communicates and reveals. And once you get that down, really, life becomes a lot simpler.
What I love so much about it, Al, is that, well, and you express this in a portion of the book, is that because it's personal and it is intelligent, the faith that we have, who we mm-hmm. are, it's an imperative to be able to listen. Yeah, and I think that's what you bring to the table that is so unique. It's not just about intellectualizing or writing and saying, here's the truth, pass it on. But because of your experience and where God has had you, you've listened. So And you, by doing that, you're hearing what others are saying and knowing how to respond to that.
Yeah. I do think this is important because it's part of who we are as Catholics. We believe human beings are made in the image and likeness of God, and that by their very nature, they have a longing for God. So when I come across Oprah or Steve Jobs or Tiger Woods, Carl Sagan, Ray Kurzweil, even Bart Ehrman, I first of all engage them not as enemies or opponents, but I first of all engage them as common creatures. We're all in this thing together. God created us. We all hunger for God. A lot of us feed off bad foods, but nevertheless, we have a common hunger. And I think that that requires, I think a Catholic is under obligation to love their enemy. And love means, first of all, listening. It means giving attention to. It means giving heed. So I've always used as a standard as to whether I'm really loving my opponent or not. I've always used as a standard can I represent my opponent's teaching in a way that he or she would recognize as fair and accurate? If I'm writing about Oprah, for instance, could Oprah read that chapter and say to herself, "Oh, I don't like what Crest is doing here, but I have to say this anyways. He understands what I believe. I don't agree with him, but at least he understands what I believe. He has the analysis right. He just has the wrong solution." So I do think that's what love requires of people who are engaged in the world of ideas. You've got to love your intellectual opponent enough that you can represent his or her ideas in a way that he or she would recognize as fair and accurate. So that's what I've tried to do with the book. So whether we're dealing with Islam or the self-styled spirituality of Oprah or Shirley MacLaine's New Age teaching or the transhumanist movement of Ray Kurzweil and others, I've always tried to keep in mind that these people are more like me than unlike me. And I have a common brotherhood with them by virtue of creation, even if we're divided by their rejection of Christ and my embrace of him.
Well, Al, we'll get into each of the different parts just to give people a sense of what the book is like. But I have to say that in hearing what you've just said, your approach to this is that you're validating and respecting the dignity of the person that you're listening to. And that's key in this because chances are we are going to hear many of the things that you talked about come from the mouths of loved ones, family members, co-workers.
Yeah, that's right.
And so how we approach our demeanor and not coming as debaters, but somebody who loves, and then you use the word challenge. I mean, you're challenging them. But doing it in love, that is a real call for many Catholics, isn't it?
It is. And we all know and we've all felt the frustration of trying to communicate to somebody who's not listening to us. They misunderstand. They deliberately misunderstand sometimes. We all know that frustration. What we want to make sure that we're doing is that when we communicate to others, we want the other to know that they've been heard. Even if we disagree with them, that they've been heard. If you don't do that, you can't get to the next round because everything you say subsequent is under suspicion. And, you know, a person you're talking with a Muslim, for instance, and what you say to that Muslim is, well, you know, underneath it all, we all believe the same thing. That Muslim is going to say, no, that isn't what I believe. I don't believe we all believe the same thing. You believe Christ is divine, and I believe he's a creature. So if you're going to talk to Muslims, I mean, I tell the story there of a preacher, a pastor, who was speaking after 9/11 at a memorial service, and he began his prayer saying to the effect of, we pray to the God of the Father of Jesus Christ and the God of Mo, and he meant I thought he was going to say Moses, the God of Moses.
Mm-hmm.
But he ended up saying the God of Muhammad. Mm-hmm. And he was just trying to be generous and embrace Islam. But the truth is, he blasphemed. From the point of view of Islam, God has no son, and he is no father. And to claim that the father of Jesus Christ is Allah is, from a Muslim point of view, blasphemous. And so here is this man, well-intentioned, but he turns out patronizing his Muslim hearers. He pretends that they don't know what they believe, and that somehow we're all just so, you know, there's some, all religions are equally the same. And I think that, again, Muslims would find that deeply offensive. Same thing talking about Carl Sagan's wife after his death and the way that she described his passing and the relationship. It's a very delicate area. But I honestly believe that if she would read this chapter in the book that deals with this, she would maybe not be happy with my conclusions, but at least she would say, well, he understood Carl's significance and he understood what his death meant to me. So that's what you're trying to do. And if you don't do that, then you're not going to be able to make your apologetic points later on, because the person will just write you off saying, hey, you don't even know what I've said.
Aldo, you think it's a case that for many of us, we don't engage into that challenge or even try to listen too deeply, because deep down, we really aren't sure what we believe or how mm-hmm. to articulate it, especially in this area of spirituality and revelation.
Yeah, that's funny, isn't it? Because what that means is that we're afraid of our opponent because we have some deficiency in our own spiritual life. In other words, we don't trust God enough. We don't know what he's taught. And it's funny that we then displace our own spiritual inadequacy by projecting it onto an opponent or enemy. And I think that's something ironic about that whole thing. But yes, I think people are afraid to engage their opposition, their opponent, because one, they don't like to think they have enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody likes to think, you know, we're really all nice people. And so I'm a nice person. I'm a good person. They're a good person. So we can't possibly have any serious conflict between us. I think that's part of the problem. And the other part is that, they are afraid. They are afraid that maybe the new atheists have an argument, have a point, and they don't know God well enough to feel as though he's going to guide them through this intellectual thicket. But I have to say, look, if you believe Christ is going to raise the dead, then you'd better believe he can help you understand an argument, for heaven's sakes. If your body's coming out of the grave at the end of time, you better trust him now to help grow you in the faith so that you're able to engage those with whom you disagree. We shouldn't postpone exercising our faith. And see, we've been asked to love God with our whole mind, not just with our whole heart or our soul or our body. We're asked to love with our mind as well. So intellectual discipleship should be part of our catechetical training.
Mm. In turn, we're called to have that Christ mind, that mind of Christ, to go out and to mission for him, to know him. In so many of these spiritualities that you bring forward, whether it's the type of pick-and-choose basket that Oprah has, or mm-hmm. Whatever, it's Marianne Williamson, or whoever is a proponent of a particular New Age or some other type of religion, they say something that sounds almost like what we know,
yes.
But it always has a hook to it. And for many of us, we just don't understand what that hook is.
Yeah. That is a huge problem right now. People, religious language is like a wax nose that you can twist mm-hmm. any way you want. People use the same language, the same vocabulary, but they employ a different dictionary.
Mm-hmm.
So Oprah, for instance, it's very clear that Oprah regards herself as a Christian, and she's what I love about her, and I have great respect for her. What I love about her is not just her generosity or her magnanimity,
mm-hmm.
but I love the idea that she's tried to hold on to her faith in Christ. The problem is that long time ago, she got bad teaching. The pastor of her church preached on the idea that God was a jealous God, that Yahweh was a jealous God. Now, the Hebrew word there, I know this might sound a little technical, but actually this is what happened with Oprah. The Hebrew word there for jealous God really means zealous. It's much easy, much better translated as zealous. Mm-hmm. So God is zealous for love. He loves his people. So when we say that he is a jealous God, it doesn't mean that he's petty. It doesn't mean that somehow he's threatened by our independence. No, it means that God is jealous for our affections and our loves. He is zealous, just like Hosea was zealous for his adulterous wife, Gomer. So God is jealous for us. It was a wonderful statement of generosity. The problem is Oprah, who I think by nature probably has a generous spirit, when she heard that, she thought God was being described as hypercritical, insecure, maybe even a bit of a tyrant. And so she went on to come up with a different God outside historic Christianity. She got involved in what we call New Age thought, but really it's a group called New Thought. It's from the 19th century, the Unity School of Christianity, and they believe that Jesus was a man just like the rest of us who discovered the Christ consciousness, this kind of cosmic energy, intelligent energy, mm-hmm. And that he connected with this Christ consciousness. So Jesus is not the Christ. No, Jesus is the way shower to the rest of us to attain the Christ consciousness. And in fact, her teacher, the one who was most influential in her life, actually thought worship of Jesus obscured our own divinity. And so Oprah's gospel has become, and this is where, you know, it really comes down to this, mm-hmm. Learning to worship yourself is the greatest worship of all. Mm-hmm. You know, that puts a little hook on it. But indeed, you keep working with her through what she says. She denies the atonement. She denies the divinity of Jesus. She denies historic Christianity. And yet she wants to cling to Christ. So there's still a hunger in her, I think, for Jesus, but she's redefined him. She's adopted what St. Paul warns against in 1 Corinthians 11, where he says, many of you have swallowed a false Jesus. And I think that's what's happened with her.
We're talking with Al Crest about his book, Dangers to the Faith, Recognizing Catholicism's 21st Century Opponents. And I have to say, you know, for everyone out there, this is such an important work. And the reason it's so compelling, Al, is that you deliver these teachings, if you don't mind me saying, with a pastor's heart. Because there's a real care, not only about the people you're writing about, but for those who we will encounter. And in a way, you're modeling for us how we enter into that dialogue.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That is what I wanted to do. When I began following Christ as an adult back in 1974, I was blessed to have adult teachers who were themselves pastors and who had a great they understood the basic truth that human beings are made for God. And so they always approached people, even the craziest people, even the most hostile people. These teachers always approached these human beings as though we were together in this life experience, because we were all created by God and for God. And I do think that that has been very helpful to me in my own work of personal evangelism and also my work on the air. It's not always easy because when you're speaking to a Catholic audience or an intensely Christian audience, it is, and I've fallen into this too, it's mm-hmm. sometimes tempting to make, take a cheap shot or make jokes. I think of something Jerry Falwell did years ago where he referred to Ellen DeGeneres as Ellen Degenerate. Because of her lesbianism. Well, that's funny, but it's not. really. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a play on words. And mm-hmm. here's a man who, internationally known pastor, who cheapened his own reputation for a pun because he knew that his immediate audience would find that funny. But the truth is, he also jeopardized Ellen DeGeneres' chances of turning to Christ because he mocked her in a way that really is not helping her realize who Jesus is. And we all are subject to that, especially those of us who are, you know, regularly communicating to our brothers and sisters in Christ. And I think you have to work against that. You have to always keep in mind that you need to be able to stand before God and take an account for every word you've uttered. And you also have to say, what would happen if the people I'm trying to reach who are outside of Christ, how would they hear this program? Mm-hmm. And I think that we should try to keep our conversation salted so that if unbelievers were listening to us, mm-hmm. they wouldn't necessarily agree with us, but they would understand what we're saying, and they wouldn't feel as though we were putting unnecessary obstacles in the way of them coming to Christ and coming to agreement with the teaching of the church. But I think, you know, it's natural. There's an insider-outsider thing happening here. It doesn't matter if you're a police officer talking to your fellow cops or if you're a priest talking to your fellow clergy. You know, there's insider humor that you make. There's shop talk. Mm-hmm. And for outsiders hearing that, they may easily misunderstand it. So you've always got to be careful of that.
It's always, I keep trying to bear in mind that I'm paraphrasing the teaching from St. Catherine of Siena, where essentially it says that you may think you're doing a lot of good, but if it's not cloaked in virtue, then it's not from God. I mean, if right. we end up descending into the one thing that we say we're trying to rail against, then don't we, Al, become dangerous to the faith?
I do. I think we are. In fact, when I started writing this book, Dangerous to the Faith, the first chapter I started writing on was how we Catholics shoot themselves in the foot. Mm-hmm. Now, we are sometimes are the ones who are the biggest obstacle. The problem is that chapter grew into its own book, and so I set it aside and decided that's for another day.
Good. Another
so
one.
So that'll hey. Sometime, Lord willing, that'll be in the future. But yes, we sometimes become the chief obstacle to faith in Christ, and this is why we must remember how we treat our opponent and how we treat our enemy is actually the first gospel they will hear. We believe the Christian story can be summed up very quickly in four chapters, right? Creation, God created, chapter 2, man fell, chapter 3, Jesus redeemed, and chapter 4, he's coming again in the fullness of his kingdom. Those four chapters, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the first chapter is creation, God created. And so we need to, when we're proclaiming the gospel or the Christian story, one of the ways that we communicate creation is by the way we treat human beings as created in the image of God. Mm-hmm. And if we're not treating them as though they're created in the image of God, then our opponents have no reason to believe that what we're saying is true, because we're undermining our own message by treating them shabbily or not listening to them or not demonstrating that we're interested in their intrinsic dignity. So, yes, we can't allow ourselves to get in the way. You know, there's many years ago, a preacher came through town. This is when I was an evangelical Protestant. And he said, Jesus said, have I not been with you so long? He who has seen me has seen the Father. So Jesus there is functioning as a sacrament of the Father. He's meant to make the Father visible. And this preacher said it at the same time. He gave this crazy challenge, which has always stuck with me. He said, are we in the position of saying to those we're trying to reach, have I been with you so long? He who has seen me, or he who has seen the Catholic community, mm-hmm. Has seen Christ. Because Catholic Church teaching is that we are mystically united with Jesus. And in fact, the phrase is the total Christ or the whole Christ is the head in heaven and the body on earth. And there's meant to be continuity between the two such that the watching world, the observing world will say, by looking upon the church, we've seen Christ. Mm-hmm. And that's our challenge. When people aren't able to say that, and we all know that frequently they can't, when they don't see Christ in the church is, or at least the church's membership is failing. And I think we hold out Mother Teresa, of course, as a great model of what a Catholic's supposed to be. But in truth, every Catholic is supposed to be exhibiting that degree of virtue and sanctity. They're supposed to be transparent so that Christ-likeness shows through in all that we do. And I don't say that because I think I'm especially good at it. I say that because I think that's the teaching of the church. And as tough as it is to hear, we need to embrace it. And we also need, of course, to remember God is incredibly merciful, and mercy ought to be part of our message as well.
This concludes part one of our discussion with Al Cresta, going inside the pages of Dangers to the Faith, Recognizing Catholicism's 21st Century Opponents. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to osv.com, the website for its publisher, Our Sunday Visitor, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear part one and two of our discussion with Al Cresta, go to discerninghearts.com. This has been a production of discerninghearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, Insights from Today's Most Compelling Authors.